All right, Kiss Army, welcome to the Kiss FAQ podcast. Thank you for giving us your time today and letting us into your head. I hope we don't do any damage. This is a Kiss-related podcast by the board for the board. We hope that you enjoy. We'd love you to support this show. Please like, follow, and subscribe to us on Facebook, YouTube, and Twitter. Your likes and subscription helps us to grow and attract interviews and content. So please retweet and share our posts. Your contributions are appreciated. All right, welcome to the show. Thank you, as always, for joining us on a Saturday morning. Today we've got Lonnie, St. Louis Kissed. He and his Bengals are resting the team this week.
They're resting the team.
I'm sorry, Lonnie.
The Chiefs laid the down.
They put the smack down on you in the biggest way.
Yeah, I know. The Chiefs,
they didn't want to see you again.
The Chiefs beat us again, you know. For all you Kansas City fans out there, I hope no one on the Chiefs gets hurt, because apparently your backups are really bad or they laid down. So you decide what it is.
Yeah. Well, in the Bay Area, Ken is here today, and the Niners are resting this weekend.
Niners are also resting. Yeah. Rebuilding, I think.
We got Daniel. We've been doing these shows on Saturday so that Daniel can participate. And you know what? It's really nice to have you here again. So thanks for joining us. And Marcus Almighty, Mark. Now, I do want to just start off today's show with a message of support. Prayers, vibes, whatever you do for Southern California and the fires that are engulfing the Los Angeles region. This is impacting a lot of fans. This has nothing to do with political bias. This has nothing to do with anything other than people are suffering in Southern California. Yeah, there'll be a lot of things to talk about later for those people to ask of their leadership. But right now, there are fires fucking burning. There are people losing their homes. I know of one Kiss audio vault that is gone. That has nothing to do with lives and families and anything else. It has nothing to do with politics. So I offer my solidarity to all my fellow citizens and non-citizens in Southern California who are suffering at this time. It's horrendous. We had three fucking quakes yesterday, right offshore from San Francisco. And it's just a reminder that California is unstable in a number of ways, whether it is fire risk, which we suffer from up here as well, whether it's earthquakes or other natural disasters. And these sorts of things impact other parts of the United States and the world. There are tornadoes in the Midwest. There's snow right now freezing people throughout the world. It can be you tomorrow. So that's my little pontification, and I hope that came across without bias. Not too much bias, because it's just part of us. Mm-hmm. All right. You're joining us live. Thank you very much. I do want to just go through the list of folks who are joining us live. Jason, Austin, AB, Squiggum67. What a great name. Ronnie Parker, Marco, Sylvie. Good to see you. G Chop, Rome Loves Dan, Tim Cobb. I'll shout you out as I see you as we go along. What's happened this week in Kiss World? I dropped a new song stories yesterday for Rock and Roll All Night. Season 4 does not have a schedule. I've tried it weekly, I've tried it kind of daily, and it hasn't really worked, so I'm gonna put these ones out whenever I freaking get around to it. The first one took like 24 hours of writing before I even got into the editing, so they're not easy to birth. I've selected 10 songs for this year, and they're again related to a theme for 2025. So if you're so inclined, do check them out. What else? Yeah, I'm fucking trolling him. This is fucking real. This is real. And it wasn't intentional. Yeah, I've got, how many books do I have on the go at the moment? Yeah. A lot of content. But Magic is the 1996-97 Alive Worldwide Tour, revisited in scrapbook form, just like Mass Hysteria was for 1980. And this is 400 pages in. And it had to be called Magic. It has nothing to do with that other plonker. It is simply because how many times the word magic was mentioned in press conferences in 1996 and 97. And if he ain't going to use it, why the fuck should no one else? And if someone gets there before me, go for it. Clearly it ain't, has nothing to do with 73 to 83, which is clearly the original Magic. But Ross ain't doing shit, you know. So I will. Nope. And yeah, I think it'll be pretty clear that one of these three fucking books is going to get done soon anyway. So we shall see. All right. Anyone else got anything? Any new purchases? Any news? Mark, anything you need to communicate with any listeners while before we start?
As usual, I have been packing CDs and, you know, the one that I just put out recently, the Canada one. So you look in your mailboxes and start checking for your Bandcamp account. I've been sending out notices of stuff being shipped. So the CDs are out there. The vinyl is going to be worked on very soon. After this, on Monday, I have to start sending him the files so he can start doing the lacquer cut for me of the album version of it. So that will be done soon. Just waiting on one piece of artwork from Wales to come back, which is the booklet inside. And thanks to a fellow member on the board here, Mr. Voice of Reason, I have the poster now rectified for the album as well. Thank you, Ken, for that. I much appreciate it. And yes, everything's looking very good for the vinyl release version of that.
Very cool. I just saw a name in the chat. Kai, that's a blast from the past going back 30 years. Good to see you. Thanks for joining us. All right, we're going to be doing some random topics today. Again, we're kind of gearing up for our 10th anniversary show next week. We would love for people to participate if you're so inclined to send in a phone message or a short video just helping us celebrate the show. It's really cool to dig into those. I want to thank everyone who submitted anything so far. We've got a few more days before I kind of need to finalize any contributions. So if you're willing to do so, it'd be very much appreciated by the crew. This morning I've spent, prepping for that episode, and I think it's going to be fun. All right, let's dig into some topics for the day. And let's, start with what got gooched this week, because someone shared the All for Nothing audio. And it was, of course, the instrumental version of one of the 1978 outtakes from Ace Frehley's solo album. I used to own that reel, and that's the transfer that came with it. So I don't know why they were claiming copyright of something that was recorded under the Casablanca contract and is musically owned by Universal Records. Mm-hmm. And the publishing is owned by Ace. But the system allows them to gain it. Did any of you check out that recording, Ken?
Yeah, I did. I initially thought it was gone, I guess, gooched or whatever, until someone else had another link for audio-only listening or whatever. So I went to that, and I heard it, and yeah, it was good. It's kind of funny. Somebody else mentioned it, and then I heard it too, I think it's what would have been the chorus part of that song. Sound is very, the Elton John, the Bitch is Back kind of sound or rhythm or that. So I heard the same thing in it, but yeah, it sounded like a cool tune that it probably was, would have been a great song had it put on his album, but I guess maybe it didn't fit right with the other material, but I'd like him to revisit that maybe on a future album or his next one that's not covers, and try to finish that off and put that out. So, because it sounded good, it just needed the recorded vocals, which was probably done on some already done too, but I enjoyed it. I enjoyed the sound of it, so I think it's it was cool to hear something different.
Yeah, Titania Bell, there's Spotlights and Lonely Nights from Peter Criss's solo album, which is fantastic. I want to hear a pristine copy of that from the Universal Vault, not from cassettes or crap like that. And there's a really shitty quality version of that circulating for years. There's a really shitty quality version of Ace's All for Nothing with the vocals that circulates. They're uncirculated are the completed version with vocals and I think some lead work, which did make it onto reference reels in July 78 for Ace. Paul, of course, you have the alternative takes for his stuff. I don't think there are any outtakes. I'm not sure on that. And then, of course, Gene, you could pretty much take anything from the 70s and call that an outtake to a solo album. Lonnie, do you get a chance to check that out this week?
I did. It was different. It was good. I enjoyed it. It was a fun little riff. You know, it'd be neat. I agree with Ken. If he would go back and revisit some of that stuff to kind of finish that on a project in the future. But no, it was. You can kind of listen to it. I kind of agree with Ken. You can kind of listen to it and kind of see why maybe it didn't make it on the solo album. It is a little bit different than the material that is on there, but maybe it's because it's a little raw and it's a little underproduced as well. So it was good. It was a fun listen. I enjoyed it.
Yeah, very difficult to get a full feel for it just off in a raw instrumental track. Mm-hmm. The real head two takes of it and instrumental for, I think it was I'm in Need of Love as well. Mark, you checked it out or not?
No, I did not get around to it. When I did go to it, it says video unavailable. Everyone went there now and it says that there's video unavailable, unless I'm looking at the wrong thing again. But no, I have not heard it. So
striked down.
Daniel, how about you?
Yeah, I heard it. I think it was a fun little thing. But what boggles the mind is this guy, Kurt Gooch. Talk about a fall from grace. You know, I remember first coming across his name when I got that Kiss Alive Forever book, which was one of my top three books at the time, I guess, when it comes to Kiss books. And from then till now, the fall from grace. I actually did sort of a questionnaire that I had on one of my YouTube pages where I asked the fans who is the most hated fan in Kiss fandom. And I just had two options. One was Kurt Gooch and one was Ross Radley, the guy who wrote Magic.
He didn't write Magic.
No,
that's not true.
So I'm just wondering, how do you think the result came out? You know, how many percent of the votes do you think Ross Radley got, and how many do you think Kurt Gooch got? There were hundreds of fans voting. So, Mark, what do you say? Who do you think won, Ross or
probably Kurt?
Yeah, Kurt won. Actually, by a wide margin, 77% of these hundreds of Kiss fans, they voted for Kurt Gooch. And I've been Gooched myself quite a few times. You know, he's taken down some of my material as well. So I agree with these guys. I think Kurt Gooch is probably the most hated Kiss fan in the Kiss army, if he still feels he's a part of it.
Because if you think about it, I mean, Kurt, you know, let's put it this way. Ross is being, you know, they're breaking his balls because of the book. But Kurt has been constantly doing stuff. Every single video that comes out, he's trying to get his hand on it or doing something with it. So, of course, people are going to hate that because people love those videos and they want to see them, right?
Yeah.
The last I heard, he was still kind of doing the same playbook to try and weasel material out of people, presenting himself as working on a documentary. Now, some of the video that he does issue takedowns for, he certainly does control the rights for. And it's a very complex situation of what he does and does not. 8mm stuff, there is stuff that he owns that he does own, the moving pictures. He doesn't own any fucking sound. Even if it's his transfer, he doesn't fucking own it. If he's trying to say that he owns that transfer, that's getting into legal shit that I just don't want to even give a shit about, because that's just, okay, well, I make a copy of your copy of your copy. I own the copyright for that copy of the copy of the copy. No, fucking Universal owns the goddamn music and someone owns the publishing. End of. And the mechanicals are a different matter as well. So keep it simple. I'm not spending the money in the courts to fucking fight it out with him, because I sold that goddamn 7-inch reel with All for Nothing on. Let's talk about the other one that it hasn't dropped. I bought this from him years ago. Do You Want to Touch Me Now, the 1992 or 91 outtake, written by Dave the Snake Sabo and Paul Stanley for the Revenge album. This one sounds fantastic, but once again, it sounds like something that doesn't fit thematically with the overall feel of the rest of Revenge. Lonnie, got to start with you.
Yeah, I had wanted to hear that for a long time, and I think you played it for me for the first time, I think, when we were in Nashville. Yep. Mm-hmm. I think that was the first time I had ever heard it. I have my own copy now, but the first time I heard it, I was really, you took me back to where you're saying, I was really excited to hear it just because it's, you know, it's revenge material. It's like, wow, this is this is going to be great. And while you can hear it, and while you listen to it, you can kind of hear where the refrain is, where the "Do you want to touch me now" would be in the refrain, and that, and it's different, and it's very, it's good. I enjoy it, but it's very different than, it doesn't have the same feel and like rawness of the other Revenge material. It would have stuck out, but maybe not like a sore thumb, but it just would have been a turn in the album where I really appreciate that Revenge has a certain feel to it. You know, even though it does have the ballad in there and God Gave Rock and Roll to You, I think it still is very cohesive in how it sounds. And I don't know if Do You Want to Touch Me Now would have really been a good fit. And you can kind of see why the decision was made to abandon it when they did. But I do enjoy it, though, because just because of the simple fact I love that lineup more than any other. Well, other than the original, of course.
First time I heard "Do You Want to Touch Me Now," I immediately had visions of Paul Stanley in his chainmail halter top.
Oh my god!
Because a leftover off of Smashes, Thrashes, and Hits.
Well, it's really hard to judge as a bed track with no lead, because Bruce could put some rude, sick, aggressive lead guitar on that and completely change its character. Sure. Daniel, do you want to touch me now? And that's not a question.
I remember the first time I heard it was also Julian played it for me, I guess. but he played it over the the show, and before a show or after a show, because after the show we can talk about whatever and we don't have to mind what people say. And one of those times he played me that track, and I think it was awesome. I get what you're saying. It kind of resembles the Heart in the Shade material a bit more than the rest of the stuff on Revenge. However, I'd like to see a finished copy of that one, because I think it has a great drive, and I love hearing Eric Singer counting off the 1, 2, 3, 4 in the beginning, and then they go for it. A fast song, cool song. It's kind of mind-boggling that it went so that far, because Paul Stanley at this point, he never did anything without, you know, finishing it almost. The other one I can think of is Body and Soul for Psycho Circus, which went so far so that they also added vocals to that one. But other than that, there's not a lot of tracks from the 90s from Paul Stanley that weren't finished. So I think it's a sort of a gem, and it's been widespread by now, but for a long time it was very hard to find.
Mm-hmm. I'd love to hear the one that he did with Janie Lane, which is the other one from the period. Ken, your thoughts on it?
Yeah, I haven't heard it recently, but I did hear it for the first time when Julian... we were on our way to the L.A. Kiss convention for the one with Peter Criss, and he played it in the car. And that was... It's a cool little song, but yeah, it's kind of unfinished. You can't tell what it's gonna turn out to be. It sounds like it has something there, it's okay. I'm kind of with Lonnie. You know, it doesn't sound revengeous so much as the other material. So that maybe that's why it was left off.
All right, Mark.
Actually, that I did hear. And I
was it from
that,
Julian?
Yeah, actually, it was probably from Julian. but the funny thing is, there was also a Pod of Thunder episode that played it, and they were talking about it as well. So I remember that was also another time I heard it a few years back. But yeah, but you know, the after the podcast segments are always great with Julian, because that's when you sometimes get to hear some of these things. So
okay. If you say so. I have no recollection of this event. No, that's cool. Kai, thanks for reminding us about that one. Yeah, it's been out for a while. I mean, I can't remember when I first got it. It's years ago, but it was during the rounds on kind of the underground scene. But what strikes me with that is you've got basically a full bed track. And there are other ones. There are Lick It Up songs, Incomplete, In the Same State. There's some from Animalize. There's bits from Asylum. There's Crazy Nights. There's stuff from, you know, the unoriginal era, for want of a better term. that could have been finished as an album, like Van Halen did with A Different Kind of Truth. And that just bums me out that that never happened and never will happen now. You know, for technical, there are technical difficulties and age and purpose and you know, meaning. It's just a lost opportunity in some ways to use those great ideas that didn't make it all the way at the time. Come on, Queen for a Day.
Yeah, that's a good one.
Hey, you know what, though? You never know. It still might get used. Don't forget about the 2.0 with Evan and Nick there. They could probably fire up those
AI.
There you go. The new version of Kiss, which I told you years back will happen. You can see from that video. Don't count it out completely.
Well, it's a new version of Simon and Garfunkel.
Right.
Yes.
No, I don't want AI faking it. You know, I don't mind AI being used as a tool to clean up audio, which can then be completed. There's a difference in honesty between the two paradigms. All right, let's get back into some of the other topics. And this is a leftover from last week, and this is going straight back to Mr. Lonnie. Is Alive 3 a bad album?
Mm-hmm. No, Alive 3 is not a bad album. It's not. It's different, sure. It doesn't sound like Alive or Alive 2, but I don't want it to sound like Alive or Alive 2. It's a different version of the band at that point that had a different sound. Now, if you listen to that album and you listen to maybe some... Is it the best... snapshot or the best, you know, representation of that version of the band? Probably not. There's just better raw recordings like South America 94, Japan 95. Yeah, there's better, and some of just the Revenge shows are better representation of that lineup. But is it a bad album? No. I enjoy it still. I think the version of Watching You that's on Alive 3 is one of my favorite versions of Watching You, actually, other than, I mean, the Alive version is excellent as well, obviously. But there is some really good stuff on Alive 3. It is not a bad album. It's a 1992 Alive album. 1983 Alive album, excuse me.
Yeah,
I didn't mention Rock and Roll All Night from Alive 3 on the song story, but I did have it in the background. Mark, is it a bad album?
It's not a bad album. To me, I'm just a little disappointed because I wish it was longer, to be honest with you. I mean, it's a single album, you know, and whereas all the other live albums, we had double LPs, and this one we got a single one, and I think, quite frankly, it deserved to be a double LP just like the rest of them. I mean, I remember reading all these reviews from, you know how it is with Kiss fans, you know, some love it, others will, you know, bitch about it. And some people say, oh, the guitars, they don't sound right on this version, rah, rah, rah. But you know what? It's a totally different era of the band. They're much heavier. Sonically, they had a much thicker sound than they did back in the old days. You know, the gear and everything they were using was much different than it did back in, you know, Alive 1, Alive 2. So, of course, it's going to sound different. But I think that they were on their top form at that time. And what better time to have recorded a double live album than? I mean, the only argument I can maybe say is that they could have maybe put, let's say, like out of four sides, maybe had one side with a Eric Carr just as a tribute to him, like put some of him on there as well. But other than that, I think that they should have did a double record with that. It was great. The songs that they did, some of them I prefer the Alive 3 versions than some of the original versions of them. They were really, really well done. And, you know, the interesting other thing about it I remember is they talked to Eddie Kramer about it and his involvement with it. And he goes, well, I didn't have nearly as much involvement. It was pretty much Paul kind of like, excuse me, like kind of nudging in there and saying, you might want to do this. And, you know, which is typical for Paul probably at that point. Yeah, I can't imagine that Eddie was correct about that. But, you know, but other than that, I think that it's a solid record. And my only complaint about it is that it should have been a double album.
Yeah, I'm going to echo you on the double album aspect. I think it is a bad album. I don't think it sounds great. It sounds sonically unappealing. It's a little bit too trebly. I would prefer some warmth to it, some depth. And it has to be a double CD. The number of songs that are skipped from it, I would love for them to do an expanded treatment of it and make it a double CD like AC/DC did with Donington. They had the single disc version and the double disc version. Right. But obviously Kiss wasn't shifting units, so there are reasons why it is what it is in that form. I'd like the booklet to be expanded and corrected. But, you know, most importantly, I'd like the sonics of it to be adjusted slightly. I don't have problems with the mix, the performance, or any of that. It's just to my ears, I find it a bit too shrill. So I listen to bootlegs most of the time from that tour. And, you know, I prefer the sonics of those than what was released as Alive 3. So for me, it's, you know, it's the least of the first three Alives. But it's a damn sight better than Alive 4 Millennium. Daniel?
Recalling that time when it was released, I was in my teenage years and I was at the height of my Kiss fandom. So the anticipation was huge. And I read in Nico's Strike magazine that they were going to release Live 3, and you saw the listing of the songs. And I was happy that they had added a new one that I hadn't heard before, a new Kiss song. Star Spangled Banner, yes, indeed. Until I understood that that was the name of the American national anthem.
Got something against that?
No, yeah, I didn't.
Man. Right.
I didn't know the song. I was hoping for a
stand up. Ken, we got bashed for not standing up once.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. No. So I didn't know. You know, there are more countries in the world than America, and some of us living in the other countries may not know the name of your national anthem. So, do you know what the Swedish national anthem is called? I don't think so. So, of course,
the Swedish
Unholy.
What does the Swedish chef say in the Muppet Show?
Wow!
Yeah, I'll sing it to you one time. Okay, but so I was a bit disappointed they ended with that. I would have seen a better ending to the record because it was so, you know, Jimi Hendrix had done that years before. It felt a bit lazy. And, of course, I was hoping for a double album, so that was a disappointment. What boggles the mind, I think, is the song selection at times, because on that tour they played a couple of songs that hadn't made it to a live album yet, like Tears Are Falling, War Machine, stuff like that. Why the heck didn't they add that to the record? That has always been a mystery to me, because War Machine on Live 3 could have been something. If you recall the tour, it was the song where they had the most explosions and effects going on as well. So it would have... Yeah. It's, I don't understand why that's not on the record. So that was a big disappointment. And but I can't agree with Julian saying it's a bad album. If I go back and listen to the Alive records, this is the one I listen to the most, I think. Even though I can see the greatness of the first album and that it was, you know, like broke the band and everything like that. To me, Alive 3 sounds so good. And songs like someone mentioned Deuce and I Was Made for Loving You. I think those two songs are real standout on the records as well. So I love Alive 3, even though it could have been way better.
You know, the funny thing is sorry, go on, Julian.
I was just going to say I agree with your two standout picks there. Mark?
I was just going to say that it's funny you mentioned Tears Are Falling, because there's a great soundboard of them doing from that tour, and Paul says, we're going to record this one tonight, and if it turns out really good, it'll make it on the live album. And they played, and it was excellent. I didn't hear anything wrong what they did, and it still didn't make the album, which I don't understand. I can understand maybe War Machine, because like you said, there's a lot of explosions. And when you're recording live, explosions can be a little tricky. Sometimes if the dB level is too high, you can get some droppages and stuff like that and weird audio anomalies from it. So maybe I can see why War Machine might have not made it, but there's no way that Tears Are Falling should have gotten removed. There's just no way.
Yeah, I think a lot of it comes down to Revenge barely went gold. Hot in the Shade, again, I think that went to 750, you know, so only slightly more than gold. They weren't exactly, you know, doing anything to justify extra songs, extra CD, extra costs, and it was merely an obligation to get out the best thing they could in that format permitted. So it's a shame. Again, I would love to see an expanded edition of that. You don't need to go super deluxe and include actually you could include all the source recordings because they are actually pretty good, you know, as a Live 3 super deluxe, but I would take an expanded edition of that. At the time it came out, I loved it, by the way. Don't get me wrong. I'd broken my knee. I was on painkillers. And it was a fantastic live album. So there's another topic. I didn't include this in the list because it's just.
You didn't include me in this topic.
Oh, you don't like it. You don't like anything that's not original. All right, Ken, go ahead.
That's true. But all right, first of all, Live 3 should have happened in the 80s, obviously. I think that was a big miss for them. But having said that, I do agree with Julian that the sound of that album, Live 3, it just is something I never liked the production of it. That's what kills it. The performances are great. Everything else is great about it. It's just the production of it. I just have a hard time listening to it, the sound of it. As for the Star Spangled Banner, I kind of understand that because if you think about it, Daniel, the Statue of Liberty and all that stuff, that was kind of part of the, you know, the theme, you know, America and, you know, and so on.
And Desert Storm had just gone on, too.
That's true.
Most Americans were very patriotic at the time, rallying behind what was going on in the Middle East. I think that America had a surge of patriotism at the time, and that's why the Statue of Liberty in the background, ending with the Star Spangled Banner. I think it's very different from today. I think more people who lived in this country were more proud to be Americans in 1992. Maybe we weren't as divided as we are today. How about that?
In recent years, you know, KISS has continued to promote the patriotism with the Freedom to Rock tour, bringing veterans on, interrupting the show for the Pledge of Allegiance and similar sorts of things. So KISS has never changed from that either. Those guys are from New York. They know all about, you know, what it means. So. You know, from that perspective, it wasn't something that ever bothered me. I immediately got the Hendrix vibe out of, you know,
Triangle Banner, that was part.
You know, and giving Bruce an extra moment to kind of shine as well, doing his guitar thing. All right. I have not skipped anyone else.
No. All right. We'll let you know if you do.
Yeah, you will.
Oh, yeah.
Now, this was a really good thread. And it reminded me of something that I had seen previously, and it was Peter Criss Sucks. Try playing his most famous beat. Now, this is The Art of Guitar, and they are an instructional music channel on YouTube where you can waste hundreds of hours of your time watching through their lessons. They're like Drumeo. There's also Rick Beato does a lot of that sort of stuff as well, and you just get sucked into this. Now, what he does is he digs into the drum solo part of 100,000 Years and breaks it down technically for how he thought it was played to how it actually is played. And it was a very cool bit of video. And that ties directly into the topic, which is the little things that you enjoy in KISS's music. And that totally is one of the sorts of elements that I love, that I hear in a KISS performance, whether it's like a ghost note being performed or the phaser effect being added on top of the drums as the solo. One of my top favorite moments in a KISS song is actually the drum roll intro to Shock Me, which I think is a Motown beat. The Motown Roll, I think, is what it's called. But that's one of my top moments in a KISS song musically. What are some of the moments in KISS songs that stand out to you that you can immediately pick? And, you know, whether it's a phrase, whether it's a riff, whether it's a vocal effect. Mark?
Well, I mean, there's a few things. I mean, back in the day when I started getting into KISS, I used to love that phaser effect that they put on Ace's solo over, you know, like Calling Dr. Love, and even like some of the other ones, like within the record, whenever they put, he do a little line, they'd add like a little phaser on there, and it sounds, those kind of sounds really caught the ear. Or when you'd hear like Peter Criss doing like that, like a big drum roll, like which is what kind of rare that he would do like a big across the whole kit tom roll, like at the end of a, you know, Making Love there, right? So it's stuff like that I always found very ear candy-ish. And early on the records, There wasn't too many of them, mainly because, you know, it was just a matter of get in, record, and get the music out and tour. But as they went on later on with Destroyer and with Rock and Roll Over and Love Gun and stuff like that, they started focusing more on, you know, the actual production and sonics of it. And those things are, whether I like them or not, they're important to it. Like, for example, like the congos, the conga drums and stuff like that on Love Gun for, what song is that, Ken? It's one of your favorite Gene songs.
Almost Human?
Yeah.
Almost Human?
Yeah. So like that kind of stuff, you know, whether I may not like it, but when you listen to it on headphones, it definitely sounds, it sticks out and it adds that sort of, you know, ear candy that they were probably looking for at that time for it, right? But those are the kind of things that I think are interesting that stick out on those kind of things. Even like if you listen to like the way they EQ'd and panned and mixed the guitars for War Machine, like when you listen to it on headphones, it's really like stereo spectrums. It's like, wow, like it sounds really gigantic. It's like, there's no way that's two guitars. It's got to be at least, you know, two guitars doubled at least, you know. It's great. Yeah. Yeah. Love them, leave them, Rodrigo. That's what I was talking about. Thank you, sir. There's so many instances like that. But like I said, it mainly happened after 76, right? I mean, we all know how much stuff was done on Destroyer. There's all kinds of things added to it, you know, walkie-talkie voices and all kinds of different added, you know, instruments that were never appeared on a Kiss record up to that point. So those things are always fascinating from a production perspective, in my opinion.
Yeah, some of the stuff called out in the thread are like, in calling Dr. Love, this is Mark St. Paul on the board. I like the way Kiss is enunciated in the line, the first step of the cure is a kiss. You know, stuff like that. Cowbell in Ladies' Room is another pick. Then someone went very technical. The pinch harmonic on the third note of the outro solo of Black Diamond on Alive. I'm going to have to go count that one out. Lonnie, what are some of the things that jump out at you?
There's two things that really, like, I try really not to dig deep, what just stands out to me. I mean, if I'm thinking too hard about it, maybe it doesn't really stand out to you. You know what I mean? So right off the top of my head, one of the first things I thought of, that something that always moves me, that always like almost stops me in my tracks, is I love the it's simple. And it's the guitar solo, and Tim Cobb just put it, what I was going to say, is the dueling guitars on the Detroit Rock City, solo. It's so damn good. I love that the first time I heard it, and it's still great today. And it's an iconic sound, and it's an iconic solo. And I love when they play in South America, and that crowd just sings along to that solo.
Yeah.
Those videos are fantastic to watch. That crowd gets so into that part of the show because it is such a staple in the Kiss catalog is that solo. It's so good, and it's a big part of the show, especially down there. So that's one. And a second for me, surprise, it comes off of Revenge, and that's the acapella. That's the acapella part in God Gave Rock and Roll to You. I think that's it's very, very cool, the way they end that song. With Gene and Paul together, and that kind of, you know, moves me, you know, a little bit. And that, you know, that's my favorite band and what they're singing about, and it's, you know, kind of puts a bow on a lot of things. So those two are really standouts to me. And like I said, it's very service level. I didn't dig deep because it should be something that's, in my opinion, it should be something that stands out to you. It should be something I gotta really like, well, what do I really think? And, you know,
yeah,
it should be right off the top of my head, like, boom, yeah, these love it.
Immediate.
That's why I pulled this out of the hat without any warning. I want to get honest reactions, and I just want to add something to your South American audience. They sing the solo while bouncing. They're pogoing.
True.
You watch the whole audience is just going, it's something to behold and not something I would want to participate in.
Yeah.
Very messy.
It's great on my television.
Yeah, great to watch from afar. Ken, what are some of the things that jump out at you?
There's so many, but just like Lonnie's off the top of my head. And it's not the droning of the Black Diamond at the end of that's not one. but the other one, 100,000 years, I always liked, you know, how the bass leads in on the, you know, kind of just a quick da-doom, and then da-doom, and then da-doom, 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 you know. I thought that that's, you know, the coolest things, you know, to start off a song like that.
Yeah.
So that's one. Lonnie mentioned about the, you know, the I think it was the harmonizing guitars in Detroit City, but I was, when he said that, it called me, what I recalled is from Music from the Elder, Under the Rose, that guitar solo where they have a delayed, you know, the guitar solo with the delay of the same guitar solo, and man, that's just it was a great idea, and it just worked so perfectly. I'd love that. And there's well, I can think about some other ones, but there's so many things, like the drumming, even just the drumming of Peter Criss on Shock Me, always just stands out to me so you know, in front. I love it. So yeah, there are so many things in Kiss songs that I enjoy. I could just put on a Kiss song and I was like, oh yeah, I love that part of it, so great, you know, that sort of thing. There's so many that it's hard to pick any, you know, favorites other than, you know, a few that I just picked.
You went to the Elder and you didn't go for the snapping section of I. I'm very disappointed.
Yeah, that's a forgettable section. Maybe they would have had a guitar solo there, it would have worked, but yeah.
Yeah, there's lots of little elements built, you know, buried within the Kiss Sonic catalog. Daniel, what are some of the ones that immediately come to mind for you?
Well, of course, the first record I bought was Animalize, and still to this day I get goosebumps when I hear Mark St. John's intro solo to I've Had Enough Into the Fire. I think that's one of his standout moments on that record, and I still enjoy the hell out of that one. Other than that, we talked about Alive 3. I think the first time I heard that one, I was so shocked and surprised and overwhelmed by Eric Singer's drumming on that album. I think he brought something to the, especially the older songs, that kind of updated them, and they felt cool on the same level, like on the same level as Metallica or Megadeth or the current bands at the time. It felt fresh, and
yeah.
One song that especially stands out is Deuce. The drumming on Deuce I love, and just doing a little double kick drum on Heavens on Fire in the beginning is also such a cool little detail that he added. So Eric Singer for sure. And if I could pick one more, I would probably pick, we could pick an effect like the flanger effect in that song on Alive 2, Ace's song Rocket Ride. I always thought that was so cool.
Yeah.
When I was a young kid, it sounded really spacey and fit the song perfectly. So and there's hundreds of moments like that, but
yeah,
those three came to mind for me.
Yeah, you just mentioned another one for me, Animalized. Which song is it? Is it I've Had Enough Into the Fire that ends? Song ends, big drum roll from Eric, and then Mark does his noodly thing. And it was only after I got the work tapes for that album where you can actually hear the click track, and he's working on his timings with that little ending run. It's just that's just a glorious little piece of both Eric and Mark, you know, on the album as well. Very cool shit. So, all right, let's move on to another one of the topics. And let me find my list. Let's see. Marcus Almighty, Mark, if you just discovered Kiss, which album cover do you think would make you buy one of their albums, and which one would make you not buy? Well, Mark, lead us off.
Yeah, I thought about this because, you know, one of the things that we have a disadvantage of is being such long-time Kiss fans that, you know, some of these covers, album covers that we see, we're so used to them. But I'm trying to think of the reaction, for example, of my nephew. He's only like 14, 15. He's just starting to get into guitar and stuff like that. And we went to the record store once and he came across Rock and Roll Over there. And he's like, hey, this is a pretty cool cover. Like he was taken by the cover of it when he saw it right away. And he doesn't know much about Kiss. Like he knows about the songs, but he doesn't have any of their own records. Right. So he immediately thought that it was a standout cover, and he's like, I asked, what would you buy? And he goes, yeah, I'd probably buy it. Like he, for example, he bought Master of Puppets because he loved the album cover with the crosses and stuff like that. And you know, he's at that very influential age where if something looks cool, he'll try it out and buy it. So I've always thought it was an interesting thing to think about if you could go back to that time when you were not a big fan or rarely knew anything, which of those covers you think would probably you would be attracted to in buying. And for me, I think if I could go back and think about it, I think that Love Gun would have been one that would have stuck out to me immediately because it has such a grandiose vision to it. You know, it almost looks like they're standing in some kind of like Greek Colosseum with those pillars there and stuff, and all these women surrounding them in this fog and stuff like that. It's like, it's a very machismo, macho sort of looking album cover. And especially if you're a young person, you'd probably be like, hey, that looks really cool. You know, so I think that that's a very strong album cover to point out as one that I think that would stick out. So I was just curious what other guys would have thought.
Which one wouldn't you buy?
The one I probably wouldn't have bought, and I can say this from experience, because it was actually the album cover. Well, actually, it was the album that I bought last, and it was mainly because I thought the album cover was so ridiculous, was Unmasked. For the longest time when I saw that, I was like, it just, something about it just never attracted me to buy it. You know, so I that one always was put aside until years later. And ironically, it's one of my more favorite records now. But back then, I just wasn't interested.
There's only one case in my life where an album cover has made me purchase something without knowing anything about the band. And that was Angel, the debut.
Mm.
When I was flipping through in like 1986, I didn't know anything about the band. I bought them solely because of that. And then flipping through Circus magazines and seeing the White Hot commercial as well. You know, I thought Angie's looked like a really cool band. Marco already named mine, which is it would definitely be Rock and Roll Over by That Design. But for me, I wouldn't buy anything that looked like The Elder or Revenge. Just blank. They do nothing for me. Daniel?
Well, of course, all the cartoonish material that they use for several records would attract my attention. And Rock and Roll All Night is probably the best one of those, but Love Gun and stuff like that, Destroyer also looked awesome. Worst covers that wouldn't attract my interest would, of course, be Hot in the Shade. I think that's an all-time worst record cover they ever did. And maybe that 3D version of Psycho Circus, I never got the hang of that. It was so strange. I would have been, you know, wouldn't have done it for me. And The Elder, of course, brown, boring door, no way. So those are my picks.
I've left the comments taking shots at Amylize, because that kind of fits in terms of kind of lacking in terms of design element, but I'll just leave that there. It didn't stop you from buying it. Lonnie?
You know, I kind of, in a way, you know, I kind of experienced that with buying that back catalog. I mean, I remember being at a music store just as a kid, and looking at all the Kiss records that me and my brother didn't have. Like, oh, look at Rock and we had Destroyer, and we had, you know, Love Gun and Creatures, and then I'm like, oh, look at Rock and Roll Over. Look at this. Look at Alive. Mm-hmm. Oh my gosh, you know. And as a young impressionable kid, you know, the album cover is what attracts you. So I think Alive for me is such a great cover of seeing the band in costume in front with the stage going on behind them, with the smoke and that. I think is very appealing to me. I think that would really attracted me then, and it still attracts me now. I love that. I love that album cover of the band. And Ace's pose is so weird and different, but it's so cool at the same time, the way he's holding the guitar and that. It's fantastic. And, you know, and at the same time too, then on the flip side of it, that, you know, I'm going back as a teenager and buying these albums and that, and well, what albums do you buy less? Well, the albums that are less appealing just by looking at him. So, you know, I think that the elder kind of is right up there. It's just it's a hand on a doorknob, and it's just, it doesn't do much for, you know. I mean, I have a live in my hand, or I have even Dressed to Kill in my hand, or I have the elder. Well, I'm gonna buy one of these, and I'll wait and pass on that just for the aesthetics, simply. So, you know, I think the elder is just a it's just such a bad miss with the album cover, where they really could have done something with Eric Carr with his debut, to kind of say, oh, there's the new member of Kiss on the front of the album cover. And, you know, obviously we didn't do that. We had to wait for Creatures for that.
Ken.
You didn't miss me this time. Anyway, you know, I'd say anything around that Destroyer, Rock and Roll Over, Love Gun, that those are the ones. Even, you know, Alive 2, just for the Gene Simmons photo itself alone, is I thought was the coolest thing I've ever seen. When I ever saw that, I thought, man, he looks so freaking evil on that picture. So that one, yeah, definitely, yeah, Love Gun, Rock and Roll Over, those are who stand out to me. It's hard to pick one. As for other ones that I never liked, you know, I always think of Asylum when I just, it bugged the hell out of me when I went into the record store and saw that when it came out. I was like, God, what did they do here? Why did they do that? But, and then otherwise, I think, yeah, you can talk about the Elder and stuff, but Carnival of Souls is like the laziest cover of them all. A blurry kind of weird, it's kind of like stretched, right? Out of proportion photo. It's just, it's like, what are you trying to show here? I mean, it's just, it doesn't make sense to show that kind of a picture to represent that album. Yeah, it's just, that was a bad one there.
Zero budget. That's what they're trying to show.
take a better picture or something.
Record label is not behind this product in any way. So we're just putting it out.
Guess not.
Looks terrible on the LP, which is such a shame, because I know that was one that many fans were waiting for to come out on vinyl.
Yeah.
This is a topic that came up yesterday, and it's if you're easily triggered, tune out now. it's just stupid, actually. But The Truth About Peter Criss, 1978, and it's a long essay. It's way too long, didn't read. The person suggests that it's okay to bash Ace, Paul, and Gene with free abandon, but Peter Criss gets a pass on his solo album. And then he goes off into why he hates it. What is the truth of Peter's solo album for everyone here? Because when I first got Peter Criss's solo album, it was on cassette. I got it as a trade. I was given it by someone who didn't want it and just happened to have a copy. And I was given the original Casablanca cassette. And I took a little boombox into school. I'm trying to listen to it in my locker, listening to it. And I'm like, what the fuck is this? 14-year-old me did not compute when it came to Peter Criss's album. As I've become a little bit more knowledgeable, I think, about music, it's one I listen to a lot these days when I'm writing. I really get the vibe. I think it's a very honest solo album from all of the members. Just like Gene's was honestly eclectic. Peter's was honest to his roots and indeed included some of his roots with the Lips material. So it's grown on me tremendously, but at 14, I did not get it at all. It was so un-Kiss-like in many parts. I didn't have any reference point. What about for you, Ken? You know, as someone who probably got solo albums very close to them coming out,
yeah.
What was your truth about Peter Criss's solo album?
Yeah, I got Peter Criss's, it was kind of a, playing that, it was kind of a shock to a degree, because it really didn't rock at all, really. except for maybe about the first song or whatever. So a couple songs. Yeah, it was kind of a shock, and there was a few songs I liked that were at the beginning it stood out to me, and I didn't, after that, I didn't play it that much back then. But over the years, I've gotten to like that album a lot more than I used to. Because back then, I wanted rock, and I wanted more, you know, a harder edge in, you know, rock. And so that just didn't work for me at the time. But over the years, you know, either I mellowed out or whatever. I don't listen to just rock, but, you know, solely or anything like that. I listen to all kinds of music. So nowadays, I really enjoy the whole album. I think it's really a really album that makes sense that he did. And I could see his, you know, he's going for, you know, his roots and that sort of thing. So, and the style of music that he wants to do. And it's well done. And I enjoy it. Out of all his stuff, outside of Kiss, that is, it's his best stuff. And it's really, you know, I enjoy it a lot.
It was so good. Two singles were released from it. Lonnie.
Yeah.
You know, very, very similar to you guys where, you know, going back and buying that again, going back and buying the catalog as a teenager and, you know, just propelling my fandom more and more, getting the Peter Criss solo album. I remember not having maybe extreme high expectations, just kind of like, oh, I don't know what this one's going to be like, you know, and it might've been the last of the four that I bought. And I think that's true. And I remember putting it on and just being like, yeah, this isn't for me. This is weird. This is not what I want from a Kiss album, you know, or a Kiss like album. And put it aside pretty quickly, I think. And but had been obviously, you know, similar to Julian, you get older in that, and you can appreciate it more and more for what it is. And I do enjoy it now. Where when I bought it, I didn't, but now it's good. There's some really cool stuff on there. All four of those albums are very true to that person, which makes up the Kiss sound. And knowing more about music and that, I appreciate it a whole lot more for what it is. It's actually very honest, like Julian said. It's very good.
Daniel.
Well, I guess I have to second your opinion, of course, because initially I hated the album. And I think I never really fully recovered from that initial reaction. But I can see there are some cool tunes on there, but it's never been a favorite for me. On the other hand, when I got a hold of his later solo albums, like Out of Control, I had a different, expectations. My expectations were quite different when I was approaching those albums. So an album like Out of Control, I enjoy to this day. I think that's a pretty cool album. It's sort of a story that goes through the whole album. It's streamlined. It works, but it's just because I didn't hope for him to rock out. I had the solo album in mind, and I lost my train of thought there.
What, you want to hear my favorite? Which one are you going to sing by myself, a cappella, right now?
No! The best one that stays in your mind. You just have to hear it once, and then you'll never forget it. It's the "There's nothing better than you." You know that "There's nothing better than me." That's a fun song. And so if you have the right expectations on Peter Criss's albums, I think they're pretty good. But if you expect it to be a rocker, you will be greatly disappointed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the guy who wrote Beth isn't going to deliver an album that's like Merciful Fate, is he?
No.
Right. No. No?
All right. Mark, did I get you?
No, not yet. So basically, my views are pretty similar to you guys. I mean, I got that album last out of the older solo records. Didn't like it when I first heard it because, again, I was expecting you know, or was hoping for more of a rock record and not so much of a R&B soul record. But, you know, in, you know, years later, after you become more experienced with music and knowledge of music overall, you realize that, you know, he was pretty true to his roots and true to what he loved and what he was influenced by. And it came out on his record. So I think that in that sense, it's a pretty honest album. And much like you, Julian, I think you were the one who mentioned this, that you found it a good record to do work while you're working, to listen to it. I find it the same way. Like if I'm doing stuff where I have to, like, you know, I'm doing paperwork or if I'm organizing something here, that record seems kind of a perfect kind of record as background music to listen to, because I find it, it's, you know, pretty mellow and pretty calm. And some of the other records that I listen to, sometimes they're so good, like I'll get distracted from my work instead of focusing on it, because I, you know, I get into the song all of a sudden and start, you know, tapping my foot a little extra hard or whatever, and it'll distract me from what I'm doing. So the Peter Criss record is kind of good for doing those kinds of things around the house, or, you know, just to chill out to. It's a very mellow album. Not still in my top five by any stretch of the imagination, but, you know, it's okay. It's Peter Criss, right?
Yeah. No, it's, you know, there are mood affecting albums. There are very few albums out there that affect me mood wise. Mm. This is one. Motley Crue's Too Fast for Love is another. If I put that album on and I start listening to that, I get very angry. I want to go out and start a riot. if I listen to Megadeth, Peace Sells, I start speeding. I can't listen to that album when I'm driving whatsoever, yeah, or I'm getting a ticket. So there's a few albums which are very mood changing. Let's finish with the other news from the week was Kiss Fan Films are back up. So AndrewScambatty.com, he is back up with all the fan films that he's put together so far are going back up online. So if you haven't checked them out in a while, do check them out.
Why were they taken down in the first place? Were they gooched?
Okay. I don't know. Hiatus? But they're back now. I don't have any insight into the why. Let's see. I'm just trying to figure out which one of these is a good topic to end on. Which Kiss song literally moves you? That's a good one to end on. That one song that is guaranteed. We've just been talking about emotional response, emotional albums. I'll go first because the answer everyone knows. They've already said it. Deuce is that song that moves me every single time. It gets me up. It makes my backbone slip. if I don't get deuced in concert, I'll be leaving a deuce on the stage. Lonnie, what song literally moves you?
What song? That's good.
And if you're not ready, say pass. We'll go to Kat.
Pass. Come back to me in a second.
Kat.
Oh, so you're going to pass to me? Is he
went on? I could say mine right away.
All right. Let's go to Mark then.
Mine has always been the same one for me. And it's always been my go-to. And even I've gone so far to, like, whenever I was touring and playing, I would always play the opening riff of this song just to make sure that my amp sounded right on stage. It was Calling Dr. Love. That's always been the song that's always connected with me. It's always the one that's got me going. And when you play those four chords through a really loud amplifier on stage, if it sounds good on stage, then you know your amp is ready to go. So I've always said Calling Dr. Love is my song.
All right, we're halfway to side A of a greatest hits album here. Daniel.
Well, if I want to listen to a song that moves me, I want to listen to something that provides energy, that gives me energy, that you know, pumps me up. And there's one song that always works because I love the vocals, I love the way that record sounds, I love the drums, especially the drum sound, and it's the first song off of Creatures of the Night, which is Creatures of the Night. That's such an great awesome song. And the lyrics as well, great lyrics to that one. So that's one of my top picks when it comes to, you know, energy songs.
Mm-hmm. All right, Lonnie, time to throw down with your pick.
You know, I talked earlier about the Detroit Rock City solo, and I'm gonna go with Detroit Rock City. I love, you know, just the guitar intro, and that can is something that can, you know, get you going in that, and you know, and the the lyrics and the verses and the refrain, yeah, and the guitar solo and that it's such a staple, and that song just, it's maybe the first Kiss song, probably the first Kiss song I ever heard, and it sticks with me, and it's always something that'll get me going, and it's a staple in my life. So Detroit Rock City.
All right, we're tied. Two Gene songs and two Paul songs. Which Gene song are you picking to break the tie, Ken?
I'm not going to say a Gene song, actually. Oh, I thought I was going to. I was going to, but I'm not going to pick a Gene song. I'm going to pick a Paul song. I'm going to pick Exciter. I really, 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 really enjoy that song. It's funny. I was going to say, Not for the Innocent.
Not even a too. 70s song, man.
Yeah, wow. I wasn't even going to pick a 70s song. It was just, off the top of my head. I mean, there's so many. it's ridiculous how many songs you could say, movies like it comes on. I'm like, yeah, there's so many great songs. It's hard to pick. But for today, it's going to be Exciter.
Nice. Well, there we are. That's the show this week. Next week, 9 a.m., what day is it going to be? It's going to be the 18th. We're going to celebrate our 10th anniversary. I got a lot of thinking to do about that episode in advance. And, I hope that everyone who's here today is able to join us for that. It should be an interesting show as we look back at 10 years of the KISS FAQ podcast. But for now, go listen to some KISS. Go listen to whatever makes you happy. But for now, from Lonnie, Ken, Daniel, and myself, thanks for joining us, and we shall see you next time. Thank you for spending time listening to the KISS FAQ podcast today. All sales are final. There are no refunds. If you'd like, look us up on Facebook or come over to the KISS FAQ message board and discuss the topic we've broadcast today. Don't forget to rate us on iTunes, Spreaker, or wherever you've listened to the show. We hope you'll join us again.